This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Maybe shaping the issues in their most poetic form. Ta-Nehisi Coates, a young writer with the Atlantic magazine, who in 2014 knocked the socks off everyone with his 40-page article on reparations, reparatory justice, was in the process then and has just completed an extraordinary work, a work that is reminiscent of the brilliance of James Baldwin, a work that one can certainly suggest is the soul of Black folks resonating through, a work that is a memoir instructive to and deliberative about the condition of Black man in society, and educative and revealing to his dearest, his son, come that movement for change. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me. Actually, we recorded that before the book was put out. It was scheduled to be put out in October, but the date was hastened because we are in the one-month anniversary of the murders of the Charleston Nine, because it is the one-year anniversary of the death of Eric Garner, because we have just experienced now, on July 13th, the death of 28-year-old African-American civil rights activist of enormous promise, Sandra Bland, arrested after a minor traffic stop. And with that, we are delighted to have had an opportunity to have this reading from the extraordinary Ta-Nehisi Coates, a memoir to his son, reading from his latest book. Let's listen.
The first is the opening section where, you know, I pretty much lay out the mission of the book, and it's all about fear and what it means to grow up under fear. This is from my book, Between the World and Me. Very excited to read this here. Last Sunday, the host of a popular news show asked me what it meant to lose my body. I was appearing on a well-regarded news program. I was seated in a studio on the far west side of Manhattan. There was a cord coming out of my ear and another dangling from my shirt. Someone had applied makeup to my face. I saw the screen cut away from the host and words which I had written that week scroll by. The host read these words for the audience, and when she finished, she turned to the loss of my body. She did not mention my body specifically, but by now I am accustomed to intelligent people asking about the condition of my body without realizing the nature of their request. Specifically, the host wished to know why I felt as I had recently claimed that white America's progress was built on looting and violence. Hearing this, an old and indistinct sadness welled up in me. The answer to this question, as you have likely gleaned by now, is the record of white America itself. There is nothing extreme in this statement. Americans are believers in what the historian Barbara Fields has helpfully dubbed racecraft. That is to say, they believe race to be the creation of physical law, and thus cousin to gravity, inertia, or the curvature of the earth. American racism is thus considered a natural byproduct and an unfortunate side effect of an unalterable condition. In this way, a great crime is covered in the innocence of science. But race flows from racism, not the other way around. And white America has never been so much a matter of genealogy and physiognomy as hierarchy. Differences in hue and hair are old, but the belief in the preeminence of hue and hair, the notion that these factors can correctly organize a society, that they grant deeper attributes which are indelible, this is the new idea at the heart of these new people who have been brought up hopelessly, tragically, deceitfully, to believe that they are white. These new people have not spread their new belief nor achieved their new prominence through wine tastings and ice cream socials, but through the pillaging of life, liberty, labor, and land, through the flaying of backs, the chaining of limbs, the strangling of dissidents. the destruction of families, the rape of mothers, the sale of children, and various other acts meant first and foremost to deny you and I the right to secure and govern our own bodies. The new people are not original in this. Perhaps there is a great power whose elevation is exempt from the violent exploitation of other human bodies. If there is, I have yet to encounter it. But this banality of violence can never excuse America, because America makes no claims to the banal. Indeed, we believe ourselves to be uniquely called to the work of democracy, and thus large among all nations across time and space. We would do well to take this claim seriously. And this is difficult because all around us there is an entire apparatus urging us to accept our world at face value and not inquire too much. And it is too easy to look away, to think mainly of Pop-Tarts and Frosted Flakes, to obsess over Blu-rays and ski trips, to live among the magnificent telephones and wondrous applications, and in so doing, ignore the great evil done in all of our name. But you and I have never had that luxury. I think you know. I write you in your 14th year. I write you because you saw Eric Garner choked to death for selling cigarettes, and you know that Renisha McBride was shot for seeking help, that Jaron Crawford was shot down for browsing in a department store. And you have seen men drive by and murder Tamir Rice, an 11-year-old child whom they were oath-bound to protect. And you have seen these same men pummel someone's grandma on the side of a thoroughfare in California. And you must know that the police departments of your country have been endowed with the power to destroy your body. It does not matter if the destruction of your body was an unfortunate overreaction. It does not matter that the destruction of your body originates in a misunderstanding. It does not matter if the destruction of your body springs from foolish policy. Sell cigarettes without the proper authority, and your body can be destroyed. Resent the people trying to entrap your body, and it can be destroyed. Turn into a dark stairwell, and your body can be destroyed. The destroyers of your body will rarely be held accountable. Mostly they will receive pensions. And destruction is merely the superlative dominion, whose prerogatives include friskings, detainings, beatings, and humiliations. All of this is common to black people. All of this is old for black people. No one is held responsible. The body of Michael Brown was left in the middle of the street for 4 hours. It cannot be expected that anyone will be held responsible. And there is nothing uniquely evil in the destroyers of your body, for they are merely men enforcing the whims of your country and correctly interpreting its heritage and legacy. This legacy aims toward the shackling of your body. It is hard to face this, but all of our phrasing, race relations, racial chasm, racial justice, racial profiling, white privilege, even white supremacy, obscure the fact that racism is a visceral experience, that it dislodges brains, blocks airways, rips anuses, knocks out teeth, extracts testicles, disembowels. Last Sunday, I tried to explain this as best I could within the time allotted. But at the end of the segment, the host flashed a much-dispensed picture of an 11-year-old black boy tearfully clutching the midriff of a white police officer and then asked about hope. And I knew then that I had failed. And I remembered that I had, in fact, expected to fail. And I wondered at the indistinct sadness welling in me. Why was I sad? I came out of that studio and walked for a while. It was a calm December day. Families believing themselves white were out on the street. Infants raised to be white were bundled in strollers. And I was sad for these people, much as I was sad for the host and sad for all the people out there watching and reveling in an unearned hope. I realized then why I was sad. When the journalist asked me about my body, it was like she was asking me to awaken her from the most gorgeous dream. I have seen that dream all my life. It is modest houses with nice lawns. It is Memorial Day cookouts, block associations, and driveways. The dream is treehouses and Cub Scouts. The dream smells like peppermint but tastes like strawberry shortcake. And I have wanted so long to escape into that dream, to fold my country over my head like a blanket, until all the bad things are vanquished by magic. But this has never been an option, because the fact is the dream is built on us, because the bedding was made from our bodies. And knowing this, and knowing that the dream is a dream, is an escape, and is not the actual world, I was sad for the host, I was sad for all of these families, I was sad for my country, but above all, I was sad for you. That was the week you learned that the killer of Michael Brown, that the men who left his body in the street like some awesome declaration of their inviolable power, would go unpunished. I had known that these men would go unpunished from the moment I heard Michael Brown's name. But you were young and still believed, and the dream is so lovely. You stayed up waiting for the announcement of an indictment, and when there was none, you said, I've got to go. And you went into your room, and I heard you crying. I came in 5 minutes after, and I did not hug you, and I did not comfort you, because I thought it would be wrong to comfort you. I did not tell you it would be okay, because I have never believed it would be okay. What I told you is what your grandparents endeavored to tell me. I told you that this was your country, that this was your world, that this is your body, and you must find some way to live within this world and within that body. I tell you this is the question of how one should live within a black body, and it is the question of my life, and the pursuit of this question I have found ultimately answers the question itself. This must seem strange to you. We live in a goals-oriented era. Our published vocabulary are full of hot takes, big ideas, actionable solutions, and grand theories of everything. But some time ago, I rejected magic in all its forms, and I accepted that I would die. This was not a retreat into cynicism. When I say that I accepted I would die, I mean that I was freed from any consideration of second lives and preordained justice. And in accepting the fact of my total end, I was free to truly consider how I wish to live. When I look back, I see that I have always been asking a profound version of this question, perhaps the most profound version. How do I live free in this body? It is profound because America fashions itself as the work of the divine, and the black body is the clearest evidence that it is the work of men. I have asked this question through my readings and my writings, through the music of my youth, through arguments with your grandfather, with your mother, with your Aunt Janae, with your Uncle Ben. I was asking it when I thought about you and the reasons I wanted you to be. The question is unanswerable, which is not to say futile. The greatest reward of this constant interrogation, of confrontation with the brutality of my country, is that it has freed me from the ghosts and the myths and girded me against the sheer terror of disembodiment. And I am very afraid. I feel this fear most acutely whenever you leave me, but I was afraid long before you, and in this I was unoriginal. When I was your age, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. I had seen this fear evidenced all my young life, though I had not always recognized it as such. I had seen it in the extravagant boys of my neighborhood in their large rings and medallions, in their big puffy coats and full-length fur-collared leathers, which was their armor against the world. It was always right in front of me. They would stand on the corner of Gwin Oak and Liberty or Cold Spring and Park Heights or outside of Mondawmin Mall with their hands dipped in their Russell sweats. I think back on these boys now, and all I see is fear, and all I see is them girding themselves against the ghosts of the bad old days when the Mississippi mobs gathered around their grandfathers so that the branches of the black body might be torched and cut away. The fear lived on in their practice bop, in their slouching denim, in their big t-shirts, in the calculated angle of their baseball caps, a whole catalog of behaviors and garments enlisted to inspire the belief that these boys were in firm possession of everything they desired. I saw it in all their rituals of war. I was no older than 5, sitting out on my porch on Woodbrook Avenue, watching 2 shirtless boys circle each other close and buck shoulders. From then on, I knew that there was a ritual to a street fight. Bylaws and codes which in their very need attested to all the vulnerability of black teenage bodies. I heard the fear in the first music I ever knew, the music that pumped from boom boxes full of carnal boasts and messianic destiny. The boys who stood out on Garrison and Liberty up on Park Heights loved this music because it told them against all evidence and odds that they truly were masters of all they surveyed. I saw it in the girls, in their loud laughter, in their gilded bamboo earrings, which announced their names 3 times over. And I saw it in their brutal language and hard gaze, how they would cut you with their eyes, destroy you with their words, all for the sin of playing too much. Keep my name out your mouth, they would say. I would watch them after school, how they squared off like boxers, Vaseline'd up, earrings off, Reeboks on, and leapt at each other. I felt the fear in my visits to my Nana's home in Philadelphia. You never knew her. I barely knew her myself. But what I remember is her hard manner, her rough voice. And I remember her man and his odd name, Grandpa Wally, which nodded to the void where your great-grandfather should have been. But I knew that my father's father was dead, and that my Uncle Oscar was dead, and that my Uncle David was dead, and that each of these instances were unnatural. And I saw it in my own father, who loves you, who counsels you, who slipped me money to care for you when your mother and I had no idea. Dad was so very afraid. I felt it in the sting of his black leather belt, which he applied with more anxiety than anger. My father, who beat me like someone might steal me away, because that is exactly what was happening all around us. Everyone had a lost child, somehow, to the streets. It was said that these lost girls were sweet as honey and would not hurt a fly. It was said that these lost boys had just received a GED and had begun to turn their lives around. Now they were gone, and their legacy was a great fear. Perhaps you already know. Perhaps it has already come to you. It came to me when I was somewhat younger, most outrageously. I was 11 years old, standing out in the parking lot in front of a 7-Eleven, watching a crew of older boys standing near the streets. They yelled and gestured at who? Another boy, young like me, who stood there almost smiling, gamely throwing up his hands. The boy had lost his body a long time ago, and he knew it. Who knows what brought him to knowledge, the projects, a drunken stepfather, an older brother concussed by the police, a cousin pinned in the city jail. That he was outnumbered did not matter because the whole galaxy had outnumbered him long ago. And this was a war for the possession of his body, and that would be the war of his entire life. I stood there for some seconds, marveling at the older boy's beautiful sense of fashion. They all wore ski jackets, the kind which, in my day, mothers put on layaway in September, then piled up overtime hours so as to have the thing wrapped and ready for Christmas. I focused in on a light-skinned boy with a long head and small eyes, scowling at this other boy who stood close to me. It was just before 3 p.m. I was in the 6th grade. School had just let out, and it was not yet the fighting weather of early spring. What was the exact problem here? Who could know? The boy with the small eyes reached into his ski jacket and pulled out. I recall it in the slowest motion, as though tumbling from a skyscraper into a dream. There the boy stood with the gun brandished, which he slowly untucked, tucked, and untucked once more, and in his small eyes I saw a surging rage that could in an instant erase my body. That was 1986. That was the year I felt myself to be drowning in the news reports of murder, and I was aware that these murders very often did not land upon intended targets, but fell upon great aunts, PTA mothers, overtime uncles, and joyful children, fell upon them random and relentless, like great sheets of rain. I knew this in theory, but I could not understand it as fact until the boy with the small eyes stood across from me, holding my entire body in his small hand. The boy with the small eyes did not shoot. His friends pulled him back. He did not need to shoot. He had affirmed our place in the order of things. He had let it be known how easily we could be selected. I took the subway home that day, processing the episode all alone. I did not tell my parents. I did not tell my teachers. And if I told my friends, I would have done so with all the excitement needed to obscure the fear that came over me in that moment. That was the era when I first began to comprehend the captive power of my country. I remember being amazed that death could easily rise up from the nothing of a boyish afternoon and billow up the way like a fog. I knew that West Baltimore, where I lived, that Philadelphia, where my cousins lived, that Chicago, where the friends of my father lived, comprised a world apart from all others. And too, I knew that somewhere out there, beyond the firmament, past the asteroid belt, there were other worlds where children did not regularly fear for their bodies. I knew this because there was a large television set resting in my living room. In the evening, I sat before this television set, bearing witness to the dispatches from the dream. In the dream, there were little boys with complete collections of football cards, and their only wants were popular girls, and their only worry was poison oak. The dream was suburban and endless, was organized around pot roast, blueberry pie, fireworks, ice cream sundaes, immaculate bathrooms, and small toy trucks that were loosed in wooded backyards with streams and glens. Comparing these dispatches with the facts of my native world, I came to understand that my country was a galaxy. And this galaxy stretched from the pandemonium of the West Baltimore of my youth to the happy hunting grounds of Mr. Belvedere. I obsessed over the distance between that other sector of space and my own. I knew that my portion of the American galaxy where bodies were enslaved by a tenacious gravity was black and that the other liberated portion was not. I knew that some inscrutable energy preserved the breach. I felt, but did not yet understand, the relation between the other world and me. And I felt in this cosmic injustice a profound cruelty which infused an abiding, irrepressible desire to unshackle my body and achieve a velocity of escape. So there's a lot that happens. I mean, it's roughly a story. I wrote this memoir, and the memoir ended like in college, and rather unintentionally, it's kind of ended up as like a sequel. Although I think this is a little bit more argumentative and less memoiristic. It starts there, and basically like where the memoir leaves off in West Baltimore, and then it picks up, and you know, I go to college, and when I was in college, there was a young man. And this is like the hard thing about like the Michael Brown thing, and you know, this whole summer, which you know, these whole past few years, which I'm not completely sure there's an increase, you know, in these kinds of killings as much as there's just so much more awareness. Everybody has iPhones and cameras, and people can record stuff, upload it, and you know, it's just sort of out there in a particular way. But my son, you know, he was coming to this awareness, and probably the first time I came to it in a really, really literal way. Was in college. I had a friend named Prince Jones, and Prince was from a very, very good family. Good, very upwardly mobile African-American family. And shortly after I graduated, after my son was born, he was driving from just a meeting, hanging out with some friends, through Washington, D.C., out into Virginia, which is just south of Washington, D.C., and he was shot there. By a police officer who was from Prince George's County, where he had started his journey. And the cop had followed him under the suspicion that he was a criminal. Prince was like the furthest thing from a criminal. And when they went back to investigate it, they tried to find any sort of way by which he might be a criminal that would explain how this guy would be killed. And they didn't really investigate the officer. They investigated my friend. And what they came up with was a born-again Christian whose mom was a radiologist. I've been raised in Opelousas, Louisiana, and had come from dirt poverty and raised herself all the way up, you know, to be this really, really prominent, you know, woman who had sent this kid off to Howard University. And the killer part about it was the mistake was made because he was driving a Jeep, and the Jeep was the same make as the guy who they, you know, had this lead on, they thought was a criminal. The only thing these two people shared was that they just happened to be black males. The guy they were looking for was short and a little overweight. Prince was like, you know, 6'4 and maybe like 180 pounds, not overweight at all. He just happened to be black. And when they ran the license tags on Prince, they got his mother's address because his mother had bought him this Jeep. And I went to talk to this woman about a year ago, you know, just to, you know, hear her story, and it really brought all of this home. And she said, you know, I bought him that Jeep, and that was the Jeep he was killed in. And this, you know, had a huge, huge impact on me. I actually, you know, in many ways, you know, it's one of the, you know, sort of primary events that shifted, you know, my sense of American history. So, like, to be there with my son and I have to replay this constantly, you know, in these conversations is difficult, as you can imagine. As I was saying, we came here in 2013, and you know, balanced against, you know, this whole notion that I'm trying to establish early in the book of gravity, of your body being captive to history, to society, in a way that you didn't quite create, is this notion of attempting to get out. Is there any actual way to get out? You know, can we get our kids out? You know, can I get out, frankly? And, you know, coming here, you know, for the first time, it was probably like an experiment in trying to get out. with ambiguous results. I mean, in fact, in many ways, I think like the events of the last month kind of made that, kind of clarified that. I mean, it was clear before then, but it really clarified it, you know. It's about getting out, you know, and it's about, you know, notions of getting out, my son getting out, and you know, being here in Paris.
After all is said and done, when do we stand or will we just run? Did Medgar Evers die in vain? Have things progressed or do they remain the same? If they can shoot a black man for taking a stand on principle, thinking themselves invincible, making a sham of that word they call justice, how can we trust this? It's time to discuss this. I still remember young Clifford Glover, a 12-year-old boy, and just like any other, he too had aspirations. But he never saw 13. Cops came on the scene, and in my dreams I hear him scream. I never had a gun. After all is said and done, when do we stand or will we just run? Young Michael Stewart should not be forgotten. His death a tragedy, their verdict a travesty. So much to live for, young, gifted, and black. Yet he's no longer with us, for compassion they lacked. Just like in the case of Eleanor, they murdered her. Remember her? A grandmother of meager means met her demise amidst the screams of maddening mayhem.
After all is said and done, we have been listening to a reading from the new book, the memoir. Oh, Ta-Nehisi Coates is absolutely masterful, a really beautiful poetic piece. Reading to you the new work, a memoir, Between the World and Me, which is really a letter to his son. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.